part of the media diet that is a huge part of it, but is rarely spoken about in serious discussions of media and rarely spoken about on this show, is sports. Well, that's going to change today. We're going to have as our guest one of the leading young sports writers in the country and one of the leading scholars of sport, popular scholars of sport. Dave Zirin joining us today, author of the forthcoming A People's History of Sport, author of a book about Muhammad Ali, and noted columnist. Joining us today to talk about sports, politics, and media. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Next February, the United States will make the switch to digital television, allowing broadcasters to simulcast multiple channels over the air and making your old TV set rabbit ears obsolete. Most of the talk about the so-called DTV transition is focused on the converter boxes needed to view broadcasts with an analog TV set. But Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report, says that the media are ignoring a much bigger issue.
What you're not hearing is that digital TV will increase the number of TV channels from 4 to 10 times. And then what you're not also hearing is who those new channels are going to belong to. The fact is that they're going to belong to the same guys who already have the old channels.
On the same amount of spectrum that it takes to broadcast one analog channel, there will be space now to broadcast several channels, depending on what kind of data you'll be transmitting, high definition, standard definition, or data. Back in 1996, a deal was cut in Washington that kept the broadcasters in charge of all the extra spectrum.
Ever since they've had broadcast licensing, one license has meant one channel. But thanks to this deal that they hatched in 1996 that virtually no one knows about, the current holders of broadcast licenses will get these multiple new channels without the hassle of multiple new licenses.
In 1996, then-Senator Bob Dole called the deal a huge corporate welfare program.
The channels will not go to any community groups, to any non-for-profit broadcasters, to any new commercial players, any minorities, any women, but that these new stations will go only to the people who already have them.
Dixon says the opportunity to create new programming will be lost if people don't act quickly. He wants a public outcry strong enough to be heard in the halls of Congress. The perfect focus for a protest is the transition test that will be held in Wilmington, North Carolina on September 8th.
If we want to make a mass breakthrough, if we want to get our messages across to mass audiences, then we've got to seize upon this opportunity. This is an opportunity to put hundreds or thousands of TV stations in the hands of other people who don't have TV stations right now.
To read Bruce Dixon's article, go to blackagendareport.com. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick signed legislation that will bring high-speed internet access to areas in the state where it's currently unavailable. Within the next 3 years, the law calls for the expansion of broadband into 32 communities throughout the state.
This is good news. This is really important news because high-speed broadband is the gateway to the 21st century world. Whether it's economic or educational opportunity or civic access, access to government and ways to simplify our lives and get access to information. And yet 220,000 households all across the Commonwealth and some 25,000 or more businesses have very little, in many, many cases, no access at all to high-speed internet.
Patrick chose Goshen, Massachusetts, a tiny town tucked away in the hills of the rural western part of the state, as a backdrop for the bill signing. The festivities took place in the town hall parking lot that serves as the local wireless hotspot. Hilltown residents are more than ready for better internet service.
We need it. We desperately need it. The school kids need it. We need it for business. The factories aren't going to be coming back here, but little businesses will come back.
There have been times where I've considered doing an internet business and just I constantly drop it because our connection is so incredibly slow. I mean, basically, I get online and get up and do dishes or or reading a book at the same time. I'm, you know, multitasking in order to not lose my mind.
The law provides $40 million in bonds and establishes the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, which will obtain federal and private support to expand access and bridge the digital divide with investments in fiber, wireless towers, and other broadband infrastructures. It's not clear if state-of-the-art technologies will be deployed in the Hilltowns, but to those stuck with dial-up, even DSL sounds good to them.
Well, we have internet at our school, so that's where we do most of our research, and then we go home and write it up. But if we don't get enough research time in at the school, then we jump for joy when we get 32K.
For more information about the new Massachusetts Broadband Institute, go to masstech.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, Sunday, August 17th, 2008. Our guest today has been called by Robert Lipside of the New York Times as the best young sports writer in the United States. His column, Edge of Sports, appears on the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. He's also the host of XM Satellite's weekly show, Edge of Sports Radio. He's been a guest on this show before, and he has a new book out, The People's History of Sport, People's History of Sports in the United States, coming out by New Press next month in September. It's my pleasure to welcome to Media Matters Dave Zirin. Dave?
Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, thank you very much for taking time from your schedule to join us and to talk about sports and your book and all sorts of stuff going on in the world of sports and media and politics nowadays. Before we get into much further, let's talk a little bit about the Olympics.
Definitely.
You've been covering the Olympics. What are the big stories from where you're sitting taking place in the Olympics this year?
Well, to me, it's like there's this incredible bifurcation between the stories happening off the playing field and happening on the playing field. I mean, of course, on the playing field, I mean, it's very interesting. I think Bob Costas made this point with the Olympic coverage that 8 is actually a revered number in China. And so you have the Olympics starting it on 8-8-0-8 at 8 p.m. And to have Michael Phelps also win 8 gold medals in that context, I mean, is really a story for the ages.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other stories as well for the Olympics, and that's one of the things we can talk about is, while Michael Phelps' story is undeniably a huge story, I think a great deal of NBC's coverage has been refracted through a deeply, deeply patriotic U.S.-centric lens, to the point of which we were denied watching live Usain Bolt of Jamaica just obliterating the world record in the 100 meters because they needed to show USA basketball play Spain in a preliminary match.
So yeah,
go ahead.
Let's talk about Usain Bolt's 100-meter dash victory, since you raised that issue. As you said, I think it was one of those, like, almost Bob Beeman-esque, the 1968 long jump record that sort of stood for decades. I mean, it was just an extraordinary athletic accomplishment. I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like it before in my life.
No, I haven't either, and I'll tell you why. There are a couple things that made it extraordinary. The first is obviously the record, 9.69. I mean, just an unbelievable mark. I mean, think about going 100 meters in that time, like considerably less than 1 second every 10 meters. Amazing. The second thing that made it remarkable is, I'm sure if people have or haven't seen the tape, you should, is that he was so ahead of the pack, he started celebrating 20 meters before the end of the race. He put his arms down to his side. He started poking himself on the chest. And, I mean, I love that because I like it when players aren't robots. But you could tell the pain in one of the announcer's voices when he said, he could have run a 9.59. Well, me personally, I'd rather see somebody be happy than reach some numerical mark. But the other thing that made it utterly exceptional is that he's 6'5". And so if you watch the tape, his strides are actually considerably slower than a lot of the other racers. But he covers an unholy amount of ground with each step. And then the last thing, I just have to put this, is that he's only been running this race for a year, which is just unheard of.
Yeah, all those things I was thinking, too. I don't know if I've ever seen a natural talent like Bolt. I mean, it's extraordinary what he accomplished.
It's interesting, too. too, because if you sort of counterpose Bolt to somebody like a Michael Phelps or a Tiger Woods, I mean, those are two extraordinary athletes. They're also two people who've been in a lot of ways bred for this in terms of diet, in terms of training regimen, in terms of how for Tiger golf and for Phelps swimming, how it's been the focus of their lives from just an unbelievably early age. And with Usain Bolt, you really do. I mean, it's such a cliche to talk about somebody being a quote-unquote natural talent, because being natural at something has nothing to do with it when it comes to reaching that level of sport. But Usain Bolt might be just that.
Well, I mean, he compared to other sprinters that, and I follow the sport a little bit, who, you know, work for years, the Phelpsian style, to get their times where they are. Bolt has accomplished it with a lot less of the rigor they've had to go through. To get those points. Our guest today, Dave Zirin, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today. Dave, do you pronounce it Zirin or Zirin?
Oh, Zirin. Can I just say something, Bob, real
sure.
quick? I was just thinking about this. I've done a lot of sports radio on the Olympics, a lot of regular radio on the Olympics. You're the first person to ask me what I just really thought about the Games, and I just wanted to tell you how refreshing that is.
Sure.
Everybody wants to know, what do you think about Tibet and China? What do you think about the commercials? What do you think about, you know, sort of like the game within the game, or if you could, might put it differently, the game outside the game. And it is, I don't know, it just felt good for a second just to marvel at Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps, and just the athletic greatness that is on display.
Yeah, it truly is extraordinary. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455 if people want to call in with questions or comments for Dave Zirin. And guest Dave Zirin is the author of a new book coming out next month, A People's History of Sport in the United States, published by New Press, part of Howard Zinn's series, which is a great honor for you. And you've been on our show a couple times in the past, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about that I want to go over in addition to the Olympics, in addition to your new book. But let's talk a little bit, if we can, go back to Michael Phelps and his 8 medals. And correct me if I'm wrong about this, Dave, but, you know, swimming is an unusual sport in which there are so many medals for different events that guys can do. I mean, gymnasts don't get distinct medals, to my knowledge, for each of the different hobby horse or rings and all bars. If they did, probably a gymnast could get 6 or 8 medals, but they really don't have that many choices. Basketball players don't get a medal every time they beat another team. Is Michael Phelps genuinely that much greater than all the other athletes at the games, or is swimming set up so it's easier to collect a lot of medals?
Terrific question, and there are a lot of ways we can go with this. Do you know the amount of time Michael Phelps actually spent in the pool to win those 8 gold medals? Is slightly over 30 minutes for all those races. Slightly over, and that's not just for the 8 golds. I'm sorry, that includes the preliminary races as well, and the heats. So 30 minutes in the water doing his feat. And it really is about swimming itself. I mean, Michael Phelps has done something in swimming that's never been done before, and that in and of itself, I mean, brings you to a discussion about, is he the greatest swimmer of all time? I mean, that's kind of more of a sports radio doofus question, because, I mean, maybe some guy 200 years ago in the Amazon River was a better swimmer. It's kind of weird. But Michael Phelps, is extraordinary for, I think, and that's one of the, I think NBC has done a pretty horrendous job with the coverage, and we could talk about why I think that. But some of its coverage about the physiology of Phelps has been fascinating, like the way his legs are really only the size of somebody who'd be 6 feet tall. And his upper torso, though, is for the size of a man who's 6'8". And his unusually flat hands and feet. I mean, he's literally built like an Aquaman. And there really is something to that. But if I could just go back, because we were talking about Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say that while I am in no way, shape, or form saying that Michael Phelps won his medals illegitimately, there is something striking, though, about the absence of discussion, not just for Phelps, but in all of swimming, about the possibilities of doping with all the records that have been falling. And, you know, and about it being juiced. And I'm not even talking about just the ethical problem of players being juiced or swimmers, but the way the pool is juiced, the way their suits, those LASIK suits, in a lot of ways juice the competition. And there's a way in which track athletes are held to a very different kind of standard than swimmers that I find to be, frankly, very curious.
Yeah, and hypotheses about why that is?
Well, I have two that I've been thinking about. So I have been giving this a lot of thought. I mean, the first is that Ben Johnson and just the legacy, the shadow of Ben Johnson, I mean, setting the world record in a time that in 1988 was just seen to be unfathomable, running a 9.86.
Which puts the Bolt accomplishment that much more astonishing.
Exactly. And I think there's a degree to which that and also Ben Johnson beating Carl Lewis, which a lot of people also didn't think would even be possible. Carl Lewis also set a world record that race and came in second. And it's interesting that a lot of that, I think, so that some of it is the shadow of Ben Johnson, the shadow of people like Marion Jones. You know, the great sprinters have had these doping allegations or actual doping issues around them. But I think that there is an issue about race and racism involved as well, because it's about also what a sport that's dominated by African Americans, what they're actually subjected to. I mean, there were complaints by people who were running the 100-meter dash that they'd been asked repeatedly to give blood in the lead-up to the race, like 3-4 days of giving blood each day, and they're concerned that that would actually affect their performance. And it's just worth asking the question about how track athletes are perceived by the IOC, perceived by the viewing public, compared to swimmers, because it's just frankly hard to imagine if, say, a basketball player, a baseball player, a football player so dominated their sport the way Michael Phelps dominated swimming that it wouldn't raise eyebrows as well as raising cheers.
But aren't these guys, I assume Phelps is getting tested like all the, I thought all the Olympic athletes got tested.
Yeah, no, there's very, very intense testing for swimmers without question. They've had their share of scandal, I should say. But the level of blood testing in particular is something that really has, from what the 100-meter athletes are saying and their coaches, has been something focused uniquely on them for these Olympics.
You were talking a little bit earlier, Dave Zirin, about the media coverage. Specifically, we're talking about NBC, which has the contract to cover it in the United States on television. I'll make a confession to you. I follow sports to a certain extent. I have had trouble watching the Olympics at any length on television for a while, because I've found the coverage to be not as much about the sports as about sort of soap opera stories about particular American athletes. I've watched it a lot more this year, and I think it hasn't been as bad as I recall it. What's your sense of it?
Hasn't been as bad as I recall. It's hard to see them putting that on a marquee.
You get my point.
No, I know, but if that's the best we can say. Well, I mean, the plus side is that they've had their own sort of delicious drama. I mean, that's the thing about Beijing is in the lead-up to the games, I said, for all the criticisms we can make about Beijing, about the commercialism, about the way the West wanted the games in Beijing so badly to take advantage of the commercialism, one thing's for sure is that these games will not be boring. And sure enough, that hasn't disappointed both athletically and with the socio-political drama happening off the outside the bird's nest, if you will. But I just think the way that NBC has handled it, there's been aspects of it that I've found very repellent. First of all, by having that, I think it's just a disgusting nationalist, Bela Lugosi, but Bela Karoli, be part of the commentary in the studio with Bob Costas. I mean, I just find him to be not just sort of an unconscionable racist when it comes to the way he speaks about the Chinese athletes, Chinese coaches, etc. But the thing about Karoli that really bothers me is that to hear him criticize China for using underage athletes, it's sort of like hearing George W. Bush complain about Russia's invasion into Georgia. Just it lacks a certain moral credibility, considering that Bella and his wife, Martha Karoli, were responsible for driving the age and weight down of gymnasts over the last 30 years and turning it from a women's sport to being a highly exploitative sport of young girls.
And so, I should add, Dave Zirin, before you go on, that if people go to your Edge of Sports website, which you can find by just looking up Zirin, Zirin, and Edge of Sports, you've just written a column on this topic that people can, along with an archive of all your other columns.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate that. So giving Karoli a platform bothered me a lot. And it also, it's bothered me that some of the sort of human interest stories that they've tried to do, I mean, have been the sort of things that wanted to make my brain explode. The one that comes to mind is Mary Carrillo, who is a fine tennis announcer but really shouldn't have been asked to do this, went to a panda preserve in Sichuan to see about three pandas that had been killed during the Sichuan earthquakes. And in this very preserve where she stood talking about the pandas, I hope I don't have the number wrong, but I think it was 9 Chinese civilians were killed during the earthquake. And to hear her wax rhapsodic about the pandas, it made me wonder if, in fact, we have entered a true idiocracy in the coverage.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin, author of the forthcoming book, A People's History of Sports in the United States, to be published by New Press next month. It should be out very soon. Author of books of Muhammad Ali and the weekly column Edge of Sports, which you can find online at edgeofsports.com?
Yes, sir.
Edgeofsports.com. You've got a show on radio, too, now, Dave. Is that right?
Yeah, doing a radio show. It's weekly. Tries to be kind of like where sports and politics collide.
And when is that aired? What time?
It airs on XM Saturday and Sunday is at, I believe, noon and 10 a.m. But on Saturday and 10 a.m. on Sunday. But I will say that you can get it on iTunes or go to edgeofsports.com and listen to it for free. So if you're not an XM subscriber, you don't have to pay through the nose for it.
And folks who'd like to call in with a question or comment for Dave Zirin, the number here 333-9455 or the toll-free number will 1-800-222-9455. One last thing I want to talk about on the sports at the Olympics, at least for now, a sport I follow fairly closely and I'm interested in, which is men's basketball. Mm-hmm. And for decades, the United States amateurs dominated basketball, with the exception of the 72 Soviet win in the controversial game in Munich. Otherwise, it was an American terrain until finally the pros from the rest of the world could beat the amateurs in the U.S. in the 80s, and then the pros came in, the famous Dream Team in 92 of American superstars winning handily. But the last couple times out, the U.S. team has not fared well at all.
That's right.
And has lost, and has lost in the sort of even-numbered years that aren't Olympic years, and they have the international basketball championships as well, similar to the World Cup. And this year, though, it looks like normalcy is in the world. The world is back on its axis. Does it look like the Americans have found how to do it right?
Yeah, but I wouldn't see this as more. I see this more as an aberration than a reclamation of dominance. I mean, they're kind of hitting a period right now where a very good Greek team that I love the Greek team, by the way, because they don't have one player in the NBA. And they just whooped on the United States at the 06 games. Those are the off-number years games, the international games. And so I love this Greek team, but the Greek team is beat up and a little old in the tooth. The Spanish team is a little young. They've got two remarkable players, Marc Gasol, who's Pau Gasol's brother, and this kid named Ricky Rubio, who's, I don't think he can even shave yet, but keep that name in mind, Ricky Rubio. He's going to be the best basketball player in the world in 5 years. And best young player, I don't know, LeBron James, I guess, will still be quite good in 5 years.
Yeah, that's a separate show. That goes on your XM show.
Yeah. So the point is that while the rest of the world has made remarkable strides, I mean, let's remember 20 years ago, China effectively didn't have a basketball team and was scrimmaging against Division III schools in the United States. And now they're very good. They almost beat Spain. They've got Yao Ming, other players in the NBA. So I think this year the U.S. will reign supreme, but they're hitting it at a time where a lot of these teams are either too young or too old, particularly an Argentina team that won the 2004 gold that is just their graybeards at this point.
Okay, well, we'll soon see, but so far it looks like this U.S. team's the best team they've put on the floor since 92.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to talk about another issue in the Olympics, but this time not the current Olympics. I want to go back to a period you studied very closely, and for a lot of our listeners, they'll remember it, but a lot of our listeners either weren't born then or were too young to remember it, which is 40 years ago when the Summer Olympics were held in Mexico City, and you've written about the famous medal ceremony where Tommy Smith and John Carlos won the two medals in the 200-meter, was it?
The 200-meter.
200-meter, and they raised their clenched fists with black gloves in their fists. And the controversy that surrounded that, and I was following the Olympics then, I was old enough to remember it, and they took such abuse from the news media then, it's almost difficult for people today to understand what it was like. And as a corollary to that, in the 1968 Olympics, George Foreman won the gold medal for heavyweight champion that year at a very young age. I think it must have only been 18 or 19. And Foreman became sort of a quasi-folk hero for waving an American flag at his medal ceremony and set up as sort of the good guy. This year, the ESPN at its annual awards ceremony sort of gave the Arthur Ashe Courage Award to Smith and Carlos for what they did in 1968. And I thought that was extraordinary and somewhat ironic, too, in view of what Smith and Carlos had experienced. You've written about this. What was the significance of what Smith and Carlos did, and what do most people not know about that episode?
Well, the number one thing that was significant about it was that in 1968, of course, the world had been turned on its head. Those Olympic Games weren't until October, so think about what 68 had already seen, from the assassinations of King and Bobby Kennedy to the riots at the Democratic National Committee to the Tet Offensive to, I'm sorry, Democratic National Convention, but to the Tet Offensive, to the slaying of hundreds of students in Mexico, the Prague Spring, the French May. I mean, just it was a year that really the world turned on its head. And during that time, the forces in this country, the forces of conservatism, you could argue the forces of reaction, often turned to sports as sort of like a citadel of what was right about America, a citadel that this country was the greatest possible country in the world, and anybody who was saying there were problems in this country just didn't get it. And so to have a symbol of militant protest, the black glove fist, actually enter the medal stand, hit the medal stand of the Olympic Games, I mean, it was very profound. It really gave the sense of, you know what, nowhere is safe from the change that is coming in this country. And soon thereafter it happened, posters of Smith and Carlos, they adorned college dorm and high school dorm room walls across the country. So it was very significant. And I think what a lot of people don't know about it, particularly in our kind of snapshot consumeristic culture where that image is far too much sort of like the Che Guevara T-shirt and that people know the image and not sort of the substance behind it, is that it was more than just a moment. It really was a movement. That it was part of something that was several years in the making called the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And the Olympic Project for Human Rights, their goal was to try to organize a boycott of African-American athletes for those 68 games. And the boycott idea really did fall through. Well, the one person who did follow through on it was a basketball player named Lew Alcindor, who changed his name, of course, to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He didn't take the floor in those 68 games. He stayed at home. But for Smith and Carlos, and people like Lee Evans, they still wanted to make a stand. They still wanted people to know that they were angry about conditions in the world. And so that's why they did what they did. And I'm sorry to keep going on so long, but just another thing that I think people don't know about it were the demands that they held. And I think that's another reason why they're, you know, praised today by organizations like ESPN, is because they've been largely proven right by history. I mean, they wanted South Africa and Rhodesia disavowed from the games. They wanted the white supremacist Avery Brundage removed from being the head of the International Olympic Committee. They wanted more black coaches hired. They wanted Muhammad Ali's title restored. I mean, these are things that I think most people would say, yeah, they were damn right to want to fight for that, and people were wrong to oppose them.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin, author of the forthcoming book, A People's History of Sports in the United States, weekly columnist and radio host of The Edge of Sports, being both the name of the show and the column. Let's go to the phone lines, but first let me remind listeners, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Just a couple of brief comments. I thought it was interesting. One of the swimmers said, I threw the new suit in the pool, and it didn't move, so I guess I'll still have to swim. And one of the sportscasters also said that when Phelps won by a hundredth of a second, that the other swimmer might have actually touched a fraction of a second first, but because Phelps came on and touched with more pressure, that might have activated the electronic finish. And a couple more comments, if I might. This is from the August 12th edition of the Wall Street Journal. Larry Krasselberg, the four-time U.S. gold medalist, during the Athens 2 2004 Olympics, Mr. Kraselberg was well positioned for a medal, but missed his finish, forcing him to take a mini stroke that left him 1/100th of a second short of bronze and 2/100th of a second short of silver. So just some interesting aspects. And if I can squeeze one more in, at
sure.
the bottom of the page, lifter Chan Yang Qing set two Olympic weightlifting records. She looks pretty average. She's not, you know, not a huge woman by any means, but she cleaned 304 pounds and she pressed 233 pounds. So some interesting aspects. So I'll hang up now and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Any comments on those, Dave?
Well, yeah, I mean, the main one that I would say is just that Phelps victory by probably less than one one-hundredth of a second.
Yeah, like 1/1,000,000th of a second.
Yeah, 1/1,000,000th of a second. I mean, it really was remarkable, and, I mean, you see the replays of it. I recommend people go to the Sports Illustrated website where they do frame-by-frame shots, and you just can't believe that he touched the wall first because the guy is just floating there. The other guy, Cabbage, looks like he's going to get there first, and Phelps just exploded to the wall at the last second. And I got to be honest with you. Like, there's a small political part of me, and I know people say politics and sports shouldn't mix, but that was I'm not a big Cabbage fan. He actually was expelled from a meet a few years ago for wearing a T-shirt that said Kosovo is Serbia. He's part Serbian, so I don't know, a little Serb nationalism. But then I guess we get the U.S. nationalism as a response to that, so that's not really much of a counter.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Hi. I wanted to return to, like, sort of the broader political dimensions that you were referring to earlier. You mentioned the corporate influence, and, you know, there were 80 world leaders there. I think it was unprecedented.
Yeah.
But I wonder how many CEOs were there and how you know, it seems the leaders were probably the corporate leaders, and the world leaders decided they had to be there, too. So it just shows the state capture business, I guess. But I also wanted to mention Italy 60. I don't know if you talk much about that, Rome Olympics, because, well, Chomsky says that, you know, the post-war era is very important to look at as far as how the U.S., you know, cemented Pax Americanis. And the Italy intervention is extremely important, and the 60, you mentioned earlier that, you know, sort of the right-wing impulse to sports is this nationalist thing, and the 60s Olympics particularly seem, in Rome, seem to be designed to, as well as being the usual bread and circuses, but to also, buttress the Christian Democrats, who were then in alliance with an explicitly fascist party only 15 years after the end of the war. Moranis, I guess, you may have looked at this book. I haven't seen it, but there's a chat show on the station that where he actually says he does deal with this political dimension of it. So it seems like this was an important time in that, you know, conflating the whole European left with the Soviet Union was the gambit. And there was a lot there, and I also wanted to point out that Italians were kind of upshorted, too, when the Ethiopian runner, former colonist, a colony, or attempted colony, I guess, won the Grand Marathon through the streets of Rome. So a lot of that's... all right, well, if you can deal with any of that, I'm sorry it's so unsorted out, but...
No, the first part...
Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, to the caller, I mean, the first part in particular, I'd love to say something about. Do you know, these were the first games ever in the history of the Olympics that a U.S. president attended that was on foreign soil. And there George W. Bush was. And if you saw who was sitting around him, it was Henry Kissinger, which seems very appropriate given that it's China, and Vladimir Putin. And so it wasn't just them, of course. It was 80 world leaders. It was a ton of CEOs. And that's one of the. These were the games the West wanted, and Bush's presence there is the great sign of that. I mean, China has the largest number of what Madison Avenue calls unbranded consumers in the world. And it's a kind of creepy term if you think about it. It almost has a slavery connotation. But if you don't yet have brand loyalty, you're unbranded. And the number of. And they number it like 300 million
of people with disposable income in China who do not have brand loyalty. So there's a race going on between the biggest corporations in the world to see who can try to identify Chinese consumers with their brands. And so you had 63 companies invest upwards of $8 billion in advertising for the games to try to track down those consumers. So this was a huge Olympics for them. And when you couple that with, and Naomi Klein has written about this, that General Electric, which owns NBC, was also responsible for supplying a lot of the surveillance equipment in China. 300,000 closed-circuit cameras. I mean, these really were the surveillance Olympics, and continue to be, of course. As for the second part about 1960, I mean, I would just recommend, yeah, this new book by David Marinus. I mean, the games that changed everything about the 1960 Rome Games, because it really does singe in your mind the way in which a Cold War consensus was really attempting to develop that put anybody who was attempting to buck the will of the United States on one side of a wall and the forces of private markets on the other side.
Our guest, Dave Zirin. Today you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Dave Zirin, one of the issues that you've written about and I know is very important in the issue of sports is how professional teams rely upon taxpayers to bankroll their new stadiums, their new arenas, and oftentimes owners demand they get these or they threaten to move a team from a community. And, you know, This summer, a longstanding NBA franchise that was extraordinarily popular in the community, the Seattle Supersonics, was moved by an owner to Oklahoma City, not because there was a lack of fan support, but simply because the owner wanted to be in
Oklahoma City.
He's from Oklahoma City. He said, I just want a team there, and too bad Seattle. You know, how can this be done? How can this be done, and what does this say about professional sports in the United States?
Something terrible. And this is one of the more shameful acts I've seen in sports in the last 40 years. And Clay Bennett and Aubrey McClendon, they bled the Supersonics dry of talent over a two-year period and then moved them over the objections of fans, over the objections of the state legislator, and at the behest of NBA Commissioner David Stern, who seemed to want to punish the Seattle fans because they thought the key arena where the Supersonics played was good enough for them. And so they were willing to keep going to the key arena. And part of the problem in Seattle was that they had what was known as arena fatigue, in that they had recently constructed stadiums on taxpayer dime for both the Mariners and the Seattle Seahawks of the NFL, the Mariners in Major League Baseball.
And the Seahawks, it should be noted, are owned by one of the five wealthiest men in the world, Paul Allen.
Paul Allen, that is correct. That is correct. And Clay Bennett, though, he's no slouch himself. He made his money the old-fashioned way by marrying it. And he's married to a woman whose father is like one of the great media barons in the southern part of the United States. And Clay Bennett also, along with his partner Aubrey McClendon, they're the underwriters of those Swift Boat Veterans against Kerry ads back in 2004. So you have here a real nexus of right-wing politics, of privatization, and of trying to use that, you know, right-wing magical alchemy where you take public funds and they magically turn into private funds through stadium construction. And one thing about it that's really upsetting, though, is that, I mean, I do believe, and I think most fans believe, that when it comes to sports and ownership, fans really have should have a say, that fans in some bizarre, unconcrete way own the team themselves, because if the team is part of their history, their imagination, their community, and therefore it's part of them. I mean, would anyone dare say that the Boston Red Sox, for example, belong more to, I believe his name is John Henry, they belong more to John Henry than they do to the people of Boston? I mean, people say, no, Boston Red Sox are the Boston Red Sox. But that they could move them so casually, though, it kind of smashes those illusions and really exposes them for what they are, which are illusions. I mean, this is private business. It's very ruthless, and fans be damned.
How would you characterize the sports media coverage of the Sonics move and the discussion of it?
Well, I mean, it wasn't as bad as a lot of these, because I think it actually shocked a lot of sports writers, precisely because, I mean, the Sonics had won a championship. and had been in the city for 40 years. So it really was, I mean, somewhat unprecedented. I mean, I think you'd really almost have to go back to really the Brooklyn Dodgers to think of like an uprooting that was so kind of heartless of a team that had so much roots and history there. And it was something that I think a lot of sports writers, particularly Seattle-based sports writers, responded to it with a great deal of scorn and a great deal of anger. And for other sports writers who just tried to look at it logically, I mean, there's really no comparison in terms of population density or per capita income when you're comparing Seattle and Oklahoma City. So it was kind of something that I think puzzled a lot of people as well. And because it's like, this doesn't make sense from a business perspective, this doesn't make sense from a historical perspective, why is this happening? And to me, it really does go back to David Stern. None of this happens unless David Stern says, I want Seattle punished for not allowing a public financing of a new arena, and I want every other city in the country to get the message.
Now, in one of your recent columns in the Edge of Sports, you had an interview with Ralph Nader, who probably a lot of our listeners might not know, has worked on issues like this as part of his consumer advocacy for decades.
Yeah, for decades.
And talk a little bit about how Ralph Nader responds to something like this and what he sees as a way to go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's interesting because like, if I could choose anybody to be a commissioner of a major sports league on earth, it would be Ralph Nader. And he's, in some ways he might have missed even a more true calling because he's, I mean, maybe I'm a little selfish in saying that, although I like seatbelts, so I shouldn't be too critical of Ralph Nader. But his insight about sports and the sports industrial complex and how it can be tamed, to me, is very revolutionary. I wish more people would listen to what he has to say about this. One of Nader's big issues is that he thinks that fans should be able to sit on a board that involves ownership and local politicians and be able to have a say in where revenue goes. And if you think about it, that's such a logical thing, because if public money is going into creating a stadium, then why shouldn't public money also come out of that stadium and used to help fill the coffers of our struggling cities? And that was one of the things I actually argued when it came to the Supersonics, is that I felt like the state legislature should have tried to pursue some form of nationalization or municipalization of the team and turning the Supersonics into the equivalent of the fire department, buying them back from Bennett, Stern, and Aubrey McClendon just for the purpose of saying, you know what, we can actually turn this team into a moneymaker and have the funds, when they get paid, not go into Clay Bennett's pocket, but go into the pockets of really the community.
Dave Zirin, I want to just turn the discussion a little bit in a slightly different direction. A theme we've talked about in previous shows, you write about a lot, and it's sort of interesting. We talked already about John Carlos and Tommy Smith, the 1968 Olympians, and the 1960s and early 1970s is remembered as an era in which there were a number of very prominent professional and amateur athletes who took strong and pronounced positions on social issues. We got very involved in Bill Russell, Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali being obviously the most famous worldwide. But the list really is quite long, Curt Flood, and you've written about a lot of these athletes, and not simply African-American athletes, although they dominated, but also athletes, white athletes, men and women. And oftentimes you'll hear some of the older athletes lamenting the fact that today the successful athletes, the next generation or two generations later, has sort of dropped the baton or dropped the ball and is not using their privileges and their position of power to advance social justice issues. Do you think that's a legitimate criticism?
I think there is legitimacy to the criticism, but I think it's often too narrow and short-sighted a criticism for two reasons. Is that one is that the athletes of the era that you mentioned, they had the benefits of organizing in the 1960s and 70s, when there was a much more profound and broader social movement to give them support, but also to influence and train them to think about things other than sports. I mean, without the 1960s, Muhammad Ali isn't Muhammad Ali. He's Cassius Clay, a person who brings in the showmanship of professional wrestling, which was one of his great loves, into boxing. So he becomes Cassius Clay the Clown instead of Muhammad Ali, who people revere. And that was because of the way the 1960s shaped him. Of course, Ali also shaped the 60s themselves, but there was a real relationship there between broader struggle and sports. But there's something else that's very different now compared to the past as well, and that's the professionalization of youth sports. And what it means is that if you show, particularly if you're a male athlete, if you show that you have a degree of skill at a young age, you are put on a track that is so narrow in terms of the kinds of ideas that you're able to experience and engage with, that the idea of being involved in larger movements or a different set of politics becomes very difficult because, you know, there are still activist athletes, and I interview them. They're not as prominent as, like, the Jim Browns and Bill Russells and Muhammad Ali's. But when I interview activist athletes today, I always ask, how did you come to politics of social protest? And it always starts with a teacher or a parent or reading a book as a young child. And so if you're denied that at that age, in a period that's absent of mass social movements, where is that education really supposed to come from?
And, you know, one of the great social movements of the past few decades that has really, I think, moved dramatically forward is the gay rights movement, the gay and lesbian rights movement. In professional sports, male sports in particular, this movement hasn't really caught as much traction. And I refer, of course, to the book that came out a couple of years ago by the former professional basketball player John Amici, in which he talked about the what it was like being a well-known, but though not officially out, gay athlete in the NBA. And do you think that is changing, though? Do you think that the tide is turning there as it is elsewhere in our society?
Well, I really do. I mean, they do statistics on this, and they do polls. Like, would you be comfortable having a gay teammate? And those have shifted a great deal because athletes are people, too. And just like you saw an uptick of athletes speaking out about social issues after Hurricane Katrina, because it's not like they live in a complete bubble. You also have athletes, they have gay cousins, gay brothers, gay sisters. And this is just a part of their lives, too. And it has made a real difference, I think, in terms of impacting consciousness. That being said, we shouldn't kid ourselves. The male locker room is still an absolute hamlet of homophobia. And it's
hamlet of homophobia.
A hamlet of homophobia.
Okay.
A strategic hamlet, if you will, at times, too. But it can't compare to women's sports, where this has been an issue that's really been intertwined in the history of women's sports, because sports has often been a safe space for lesbians in general. So going into sports really as a method of just trying to cope with their lives in a very homophobic society.
Yeah, and, you know, there's one athlete that's become prominent in the past decade, and really his prominence went outside of sports. I'm sure there are others that included, but one in particular that you've written about is Pat Tillman, the former NFL star defensive back who gave up his career early in his career, gave up a huge contract for many millions of dollars after 9/11 in a patriotic surge of his own. He enlisted in the Marines, I believe.
Army Rangers.
Army Rangers. I knew it was one of the elite units.
Yep.
And went to fight terrorism in Afghanistan. And his story, I think, is truly extraordinary. You've written a great deal about it. And I don't think a lot of people have heard the name. They know there's something going on there. But I still think it's a story that's largely underreported. Share with us what the Pat Tillman story.
Well, the part that I think is underreported, I'm sure people know the particulars about him dying in Afghanistan, about there being several investigations into the circumstances around his death. And about the struggle that his family has gone through to try to find out the truth about Pat Tillman. And I've spoken to and interviewed members of his family, and the part of the story that I think is far less known is the way in which Pat Tillman was starting to doubt the war on terror, doubt the U.S. imperial project in the Middle East. And that's something that we really don't talk about.
Well, particularly if I can interject, Dave, that because when he did die, he was held up by the Bush administration as a poster child for militarism and for patriotism, that he was someone to look up to and emulate.
Well, in many ways, he still is. I mean, there's a USO base in Bagreb, Afghanistan, called the Pat Tillman Base that was inaugurated by Paul Tagliabue, the then commissioner of the NFL, alongside members of the U.S. Armed Forces and the Pentagon. Leaders in the Pentagon. And, of course, Bagreb, Afghanistan was a place where some of the worst torture is known to have taken place as well. So there's a terrible irony there. So he's still used by the NFL whenever they want to clothe themselves in patriotic colors. And the thing about that that's particularly noxious is because, it, first of all, it's something that Pat Tillman, even when he was feeling that patriotic surge, he would have abhorred. He ran from the kind of attention and G.I. Joe, Army of One stuff that the Army wanted to do with him. And then, he was somebody who had to do several missions in Iraq. He told friends he thought that was illegal. He started to read Chomsky, and he wrote a letter to Chomsky. And in his mother, Mary Tillman's recent book, her autobiography, which is called Boots on the Ground at Dusk, it's a terrific book. She recalls a conversation they had. I don't even think Mary Tillman realized how incendiary this was. But she recalled a conversation she had with Pat where he spoke about his admiration for Rachel Corrie, who was the young woman who was killed after a Israeli bulldozer, a woman from the United States. A bulldozer ran her over that was trying to wreck a house in occupied Palestine.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. Yeah, Tillman was a voracious reader, as I recall, as well, mm-hmm. and kept avid journals. But at any rate...
That were destroyed.
Yeah, that's right, that were destroyed conspicuously, it seems like, mm-hmm. When he was killed in friendly fire. Mm-hmm. You know, I would like to switch now. We only have a few minutes left, Dave Zirin, and you know, we do have a presidential race this year, as you know, that's getting a lot of attention. And it does feature the first African-American candidate for one of the two dominant parties in the United States, in Obama. And I know that from my own following the situation that in sports like basketball and professional football, where a significant percentage of the players are African-American, it strikes me that there's more interest in politics than there has been in years past. Is that your sense?
Yeah, I mean, when you have people like Greg Oden endorse Obama, Greg Oden is a 19-year-old basketball player for the Portland Trailblazers. He went to Ohio State. He was a big star and a huge high school star in Ohio. And the day before the Ohio primaries, Oden endorses Obama and gives them permission to put it up on his website. And, yeah, that tells you something different in the air, for sure. And certainly people like Charles Barkley. Oh, I got to tell you this real quick before we go. Charles Barkley was asked if he thought Michael Phelps was the greatest Olympian ever, and Charles Barkley said, actually, I think Tommy Smith and John Carlos were the greatest Olympians ever. I just wanted to relay that to you. Thought you'd like that.
I do.
Yeah, but just to say that, no, there's certainly interest. I mean, I speak to NBA players who, you know, they're trying to organize themselves into sort of an Athletes for Obama kind of a thing and are very excited about Obama's chances. And Obama, you know, he sort of has a kind of jock cool cachet that allows him to connect with athletes very successfully. And he's got, like, a certain soft touch. I mean, my friend Eitan Thomas, who plays for the Washington Wizards, he had very serious open-heart surgery. And he had a letter waiting for him when he got out of surgery, and it was a letter, a get-well note from Barack Obama. And so it's just kind of like, oh, little things like that really do go a long way for athletes. But John McCain, make no mistake about it, has massive support among owners in the sporting industry. They mm-hmm. just came out with a report about this. So it'll be interesting, the battle for the soul of sports, McCain versus Obama.
And as a footnote on that, Obama was played as an active player on, I think, a state championship team in Hawaii when he was in high school.
Yeah, you could still see clips of it up on YouTube, actually. He wasn't bad.
No, that's not bad at all.
I have serious disagreements with Obama, but his athletic prowess isn't one of them.
You know, one of the other areas you've written about, and you've written about so much in sports, and I do want to encourage our listeners to go to edgeofsports.com or to go look up Zirin, Z-I-R-I-N, on the Internet. Go to search engine, look it up, and go to the radio show and download it, because you cover the full range of issues. We've barely touched on what you talk about. But one of the areas that you have really zeroed in on has been sort of the demonization of drug use. Barry Bonds in particular in the past.
Sure.
And now this is still a lingering issue. It seems that Bonds' reputation is in tatters at this point. Where do we stand with regard to drugs, and what's your take on the use of drugs in baseball at this point?
That's a big question. I mean, you look at it both from a statistical perspective in terms of number of home runs hit and a perspective of, like, how... the degree of public scrutiny on drug use, and I have little doubt, and a lot of experts have little doubt, that it's down somehow this year. Although with the growth of masking agents, it's impossible to know for sure.
Well, the home runs are down, if that's any indication.
Yeah, the home runs being down are an indication, but it's such a bizarre, hypocritical morality play. It's hard for me to even get my head around it half the time. I mean, why does Major League Baseball invest millions of dollars to develop talent in the Dominican Republic? And the Dominican Republic is a place where steroids are available over the counter, and they're as easy to get as Tylenol. And so it's something that it's like, I think Major League Baseball is still just an act of abject hypocrisy, and their efforts to try to put the whole of the steroid era on the shoulders of Barry Bonds, and I guess now by extension because of his ego, Roger Clemens, may prove to be successful. But there was something particularly noxious about when Andy Pettit was filleted for taking performance enhancers. And the story of Andy Pettit, who was pitching for the Yankees and the Houston Astros, the story of Pettit was that he had an injury, and he took steroids as a way to heal. He did one cycle. And when you think about how players are always asked from when they're a little kid to take one for the team, that it doesn't matter if you get hurt, that they're willing to have their sprayed and shot up with Novocaine and all cortisone and all kinds of things so they could go out and perform. The fact that some things are performance enhancers that deserve you the scorn of a nation, and other things are just like, wow, you're so gutsy, you'll do anything for the team, to me speaks of a sports world that is cannibalizing itself, that really is just so wrapped up in its own both self-importance and hypocrisy and Elmer Gantry-style Bible-thumping about where the way things ought to be relative to then how things really are. They don't even know what they're doing. They're in a pretzel right now in terms of drugs and what role drugs and performance enhancers should have in sports.
You know, Dave Zirin, we've only got about a minute or so left. Looking ahead the next 6 months to year, year and a half, looking at what you're going to be covering and what's going on, what do you think the big stories are going to be in sports in the United States in the next year or so?
Yikes, other than doing my book tour for A People's History of Sports.
And we'll get you back for that, don't
okay. I was going to say, like, that's going to dominate a lot of my life the next 6 months. But, I mean, I think a big story over the next 6 months, a big story that we're going to be thinking about a lot, is the issue of globalization and basketball and the way to which you're starting to see NBA players look at Europe as a serious option. And what does David Stern do about that? And are we hitting a situation with the financial crisis of the dollar and the ascension of the euro that sees actually an exodus of American-born players going to play in Europe? It'll be a fascinating thing to watch, and a fascinating thing to watch how David Stern deals with it.
Dave Zirin, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Uh-oh.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a joy, as always, to have you with us.
Oh, absolutely. I love it.
And good luck with your new book, A People's History of Sport in the United States. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for arranging the show, and Dave Heckman for working the board. Be back in 1 week with Gigi Durham. Until then, have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly sunshine is in today's forecast for for Champaign-Urbana and the area, the high around 83 degrees, west winds between 5 to 10 miles an hour. Tonight, clear skies with a low around 56, light westerly winds. Mostly sunny tomorrow, the high around 86 degrees, light west winds. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, the low around 58, light southwesterly winds. And a sunny Tuesday lies ahead with a high around 88 degrees. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urban.